Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 72 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. This week's episode is brought to you by Podcorn, a new online marketplace where podcasters and sponsors can connect to bring the best of both worlds to you, the listener. Sponsors upload information about themselves, who they are, what they care about, and what they offer. And podcasters do the same, using the list feature to see what's out there and to find the best fit. Podcorn makes it possible for both sponsors and podcasters to collaborate and come up with content that works for everybody, especially you, so that you get the information that you can use. I like it because it gives me freedom, creativity, and flexibility, so I don't have to rely on ads that just don't work for us. So thanks, Podcorn, for sponsoring today's journey into the medieval world. To find out more about Podcorn and how it works, check out podcorn.com. When you think of page-turning reads, chances are medieval chronicles aren't the first thing that springs to mind. Often, the really interesting tidbits of history are found buried in the middle of weather reports and notes on who succeeded who as abbot of the local monastery. But occasionally, you come across something that's pretty much all action, start to finish. One of these chronicles is The Murder of Charles the Good by Gilbert of Bruges. Today, Peter Konieczny from Medievalist.net is back to tell us about this eyewitness account of the infamous assassination of a 12th century count, told breathlessly, with great detail, and with no holds barred by a local notary. It's definitely one of the most riveting medieval chronicles I've ever read. So without further ado, let's talk about the murder of Charles the Good. All right, so Peter, a couple weeks ago, you had me reading The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, because that's one of your favorite books, if not your favorite book, from the Middle Ages. And now, on vacation, you sent me away with a book called The Murder of Charles the Good to read, which is your other favorite book from the Middle Ages, right?
Yeah, it was like the first kind of medieval European text I ever read, every translation. And this is way back in like undergraduate university.
So like almost the Middle Ages, right? Oh, that's a cheap shot. Okay. Ouch. So The Murder of Charles the Good. Let's tell people about The Murder of Charles the Good before we dig into it, because I had not read this before, and it's an epic story, man. It's got everything. It is really something for people to read. And of course, the lawnmower is going by me just as I'm talking about this. Okay, The Murder of Charles the Good. What is it about?
Okay, there is a Count Charles of Flanders. It talks a little bit about his reign, but it's mostly about how he is assassinated in a church in the year 1127. And this is an account written by one of his younger court officials. His name is Galbert of Bruges. And he goes in and he says, like, all right, here's his description of the murder. And then he has this, what happens in the, like, hours and days and weeks that happen afterwards, where there's a big kind of, I guess, scrum for power and revenge that take place.
Yeah, and it takes place over the course of a year. And so we have Galbert who's writing, just kind of recording the things as they happen, which is kind of funny because you can see how he shifts how he's telling the story as it happens. So Charles the Good, he's a Count of Flanders, and they call him Charles the Good because he seems to have been a pretty nice guy, right? He's giving people food during a famine, and he's giving people alms when they need it, right? He seems like a pretty nice guy.
On first sight, he does, right? Like, he's, and Galbert, it's his hero. Like, the very first lines is like, Galbert writes, is like, there are a lot of great kings and princes in Europe right now, but nobody is better than Charles. Like, nobody. Like, he's just the most awesome person.
Yeah, so. I think it's worth reading that quote because it's like, okay. It's really intense.
So, I was paraphrasing.
You were paraphrasing, yeah. So this is what he says about Charles. And it's really something because he's actually addressing the princes of Europe. He says, in comparison with him, all you earthly princes are less worthy and less powerful, lacking experience and judgment, and disorderly in habits. So that is like a big, bold statement to be saying to all the princes of Europe. But this is how he feels.
And like at this point, like Flanders is a kind of a small, like, semi-independent county, it's kind of, you know, a bit controlled by the Holy Roman Empire, a bit controlled by France, It's one of those places where it's in between all these other kind of bigger powers, right? And it's not like Charles is like some leading light in Europe, but, you know, he's got his own little kind of place.
Yeah.
In the spot.
Yeah, Flanders is pretty wealthy, especially with wool trade and stuff like that. But yeah, he isn't the Holy Roman Emperor, although he's being offered the crown to be the Holy Roman Emperor. And he's being offered the crown of Jerusalem as well. Yeah.
But he's so, that's such a nice guy, he declines it.
He declines both, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's Charles the Good. It turns out that he gets into a little bit of a spat with his chancellor, who's a provost named...
Bertulf,
right. And Charles is starting to suspect that maybe Bertulf's family is a family of serfs going back, which would mean that they might be under his control.
Yeah, like this is the Arimbold clan, and I guess, like, even before, like, Charles is around, these are kind of, like, the kind of administrative officials that, you know, have a large role in, you know, how the county is governed. They have a lot of high positions. Like, Bertulf is the chancellor of Flanders and the provost of Bruges. And all of this, like, they're either, like, a high-ranking clergy or kind of high officials, or they have castles here or there, so... But Charles seems to have found some sort of document that kind of indicates these guys don't deserve their high status. And I think this is a way for Charles to kind of like put the screws into these people.
Yeah, it's brought before the court that maybe they are not noble after all. Someone accuses them of not being free. And so it starts to get investigated. And the translator that we have for the edition that I was reading, James Bruce Ross, she says that maybe Charles was thinking of deposing Bertulf, and maybe this is how it started. But the murder happens during Lent in a church, so it's already dramatic right from the beginning.
Yeah, like there's all this big plot that is happening. There's apparently quite a lot of people involved in this plot. But on just like one morning in Lent, Charles is praying in front of the church, like praying inside the church, just about to get communion. Everything's good, and they come in behind him and start like hacking him. Like, so this is a kind of classic murder, you know, as bad as you can be murder. And Galbert, I think, describes like at least twice, like kind of two versions of this account. So,
yeah. So they go in, they kill Charles, they kill a couple of his friends, they leave them for dead at least, and they go out. This church that he gets killed in the middle of his own castle. And then they go and kill a whole bunch of other people that they think, you know, are against them, are enemies. And at one point, there's even one guy who's a castellan, not even of Bruges, and he gets left for dead. They come back to make sure that everybody that they wanted to kill was dead. They drag him out, and then they kill him again. After he's fortunately received last rites while he's lying in the church bleeding to death. But yeah, Charles is killed right away, and a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah, yeah. For Galbert, you know, like, you have to assume that Galbert is an eyewitness to a lot of this stuff himself. So he's describing fairly graphic matters. But it's one of those where, yeah, like they're trying to get rid of all their enemies in kind of one single, you know, frenzy of attack. And I guess their hope was that they would do this and the citizens of Bruges and the citizens of Flanders would kind of accept it, like a fait accompli.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen.
That's not what happens. And I think you're right that this Galbert who's writing the account, he might have been an eyewitness because he's giving really important details like where some of the people are hiding in the church before, you know, the assassins come and drag them out. There's a guy that's hiding in a cupboard meant for the priests and the canon's equipment, you know. There's people who are hiding behind the Palm Sunday palms. Like it's crazy the amount of detail that's in there. Okay, so the assassins, they kill Charles, but it doesn't go as planned. People don't actually accept that this was a good thing, do they?
Yeah, within a couple of days, there's like an uprising against the Arimbold clan. And there's an attack, and they're basically forced into the castle within Bruges. And then everyone starts to besiege them, like this townsfolk. It's very chaotic, right? Especially these kind of first few days where they're just fighting like it over who controls this kind of little castle within the town. So,
Yeah, and they have to hole up in the castle because they're getting surrounded. And people come from all over Flanders, and they even start coming from France. And they're trying to vie for power, trying to take over this countship. What is it called? I've got the wrong word here. But the people of Bruges are like, you can't come in unless you promise to leave us alone and only go after the people in the castle. And I like little details like that where they're saying, listen, we know that you might take this opportunity to rob us. Don't do it or you're not coming in the gates.
Yeah, there's the bit of a rivalry with the people of Ghent. Mm-hmm. They come in, you know, with their ladders and they're going to try and... So you have this kind of like, it's really interesting kind of conflict in miniature. It's really kind of like, they're not really good at sieging these townsfolk, right? They're not. They try, like the people who are besieged, some of them even get out. Like they slip out at the night, things like that.
Yeah, it's this weird mixture of something that's absolutely brutal and savage, like the execution, the assassination itself, the execution of some of the traitors, really, really brutal stuff. But then also you have the other human side where the people from the church inside the castle, they've been outside the walls and they're like, can we please just have our relics? Because once this goes south, people are going to just loot them. Can we just have the relics? And so they climb ladders. And they're allowed to take the relics out and back into the city. So you have like kind of this human element in this, which I really like.
The one thing that made this chronicle so interesting for me is just how Galbert is kind of writing it. It seems like day after day, like, you know, he has like, this is what happened today. And he'll write, you know, a bunch of things. It almost sounds like this is like the closest we have like a newspaper reporter, like embedded in the scene, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like you would now have people, you know, who are on the front lines of something that's happening on Twitter and they're tweeting out frantically what's going on. But you picture like poor Galbert is, he has to get his ink, he has to get his quills, and he has to like sit down and write this at the end of the day. But he does really make a point of saying, you know, I'm under fire here. This is a difficult time and I managed to write this despite that. The fact that he's writing this at all is kind of miraculous, and the fact that it survived is kind of miraculous too.
Yeah, I'm gonna just read out like the kind of like what he actually says at one point, because I think it's just so awesome. And so it says, and it should be noted that it was in the midst of such a great uproar of events and the burning of so many houses set on fire by burning arrows shot onto the roof of the town by night from within the castle and by brigands from outside in the hope of stealing something for themselves. And so many mortal dangers during the nights, and so many conflicts during the days, that I, Galbert, since I had no place for writing, noted down on tablets a summary of the events that were going on, until at some point, in a long-for moment of peace during the night or day, I could, in order, present a description according to what had happened. In this way, constrained as I was, I transcribed for the faithful what you were, what you see and read. Given the confusion and the endless number of things going on, I did not note down what individuals did, but noted down what intent mind only for things that were accomplished by common edict. And I forced myself to do this as if I were unwilling in order to entrust them to writing.
Yeah, so there he is writing on a wax tablet because he doesn't have time in the middle, in the thick of things, to get out his ink and paper. So
yeah.
It's crazy. It's insane.
This is, I think, probably one of the most personable accounts I've like ever read, Middle Ages or otherwise. Just he has it all out there, which is what part of it is. Part of it makes such an interesting story. So
yeah, so the bad guys. The provost and his nephews, who are most of this coalition that's gone and killed Charles the Good, eventually their castle is besieged. That's really interesting how it gets breached. Gets breached by night, which is cool. A lot of the siege stuff is happening at night, and they finally get backed into the church. So the church where Charles's body is still lying, they are backed into there, and they have to defend that spot, which is pretty cool. I mean, it's not cool. It's a cool description because you have people shooting arrows from outside at them. They have covered up the windows with things like mattresses from the canon's dormitory, which is attached to the church. So they've taken out these mattresses. They're covering up the windows. Eventually, people get into the church. They're on the second floor of the church, kind of in this gallery that seems to overlook a lot of the church. And they're throwing stuff down. They're throwing down, like, chairs and whatever they can get onto the people who are down there. They're setting fires on the roof next door so that people can't get in. They have a battering ram trying to get through the wall of the church. It's all described in such amazing detail that it's a very vivid account of these people who are defending this church.
So we have that, like, so we have this kind of account. It's like this kind of like what's happening in Bruges itself. But there's also like a larger like political issue because, you know, Charles never had any kids. So his county is up for grabs and all the kind of big powers put their candidate forward. We have like Henry I of England. He's kind of supporting a guy named William of Ypres, who may have been involved in the plot as well. So he's kind of like another kind of local noble. He gets the support of Henry. Louis the Fat of France, Louis VI, he has his own candidate, which is named William Clito. And he's really interesting, too, because he is Henry's nephew, the son of Robert Curthouse. Henry had defeated Robert Curthouse like in the year 1106 in battle and took over Normandy and kept Robert in prison since then. So Robert actually may still be alive in like some English castle as a captive there. But William Clito has a very good claim on Normandy. And this is, I think, Louis is in his endless battles with the Normans is trying to give William Clito like, this kind of power base. So he's kind of trying to set him up as the new count. And meanwhile, also the Holy Roman Emperor is trying to get another third guy.
Yeah. So Louis manages to get William Clito to be the count. And he does this by taking advice from all sorts of people. And again, this is another thing where it's not just a unilateral decision. He has advice from people. Everyone seems to be okay with this. William Clito takes power. But he's not a very good count, in that he starts to get taxes and tolls and stuff from the burghers, which they had asked him not to do. He starts to do this. And so the people of Bruges, still unhappy, try to replace him. They do replace him with another guy named Thierry. And he's the cousin of Charles the Good. And so you have, you know, the guy that the King of France said should be the count. And then they have the person that they say should be the count. And so Bruges is under attack. Again, it like over the course of a year, these two counts are fighting it out. And I really like Galbert's description because when William Clito takes over, everyone had agreed that this would be a good idea. So he describes him as being, you know, all right, pretty all right guy. But then as time goes on, he starts to really talk about him in terms that are much less flattering as time goes on.
Yeah, this, like, it's really interesting, like, this, all the kind of political, this kind of stuff that's really over Galbraith's head. Like, he has his opinion. You can tell he's, like, hearing what others are telling him. And, like, some people, oh, they must be wrong. They're, you know, just stuff like that. But as it goes on, his own opinion kind of changes. The way I got introduced to this text, way back in my, like, first year undergraduate course, I was actually given a document. It was a whole class, and it was this charter from the year 1127 from Bruges. It's 13, 14 points of what this new charter was. But we weren't given any context. This was like, oh, there's a new count, and this is the charter. And I remember, I wanted to learn more about it, but man, that's not the way to teach. You know, just
That's not right that you're going with that.
We're going to give you like this charter and, you know, we'll give you this dry with like no details at all. And you try and figure it out. Right. But you could have given me this text, you know, to read this wonderful, exciting text. But no, I got the charter, which is about taxes and tolls.
Although if it wasn't for the taxes and tolls, you know, they wouldn't have had a problem with William Clito and they wouldn't have, fighting for a long time over this.
Yeah, they didn't tell us about that either. So like, you know, like, it's like everything was fine. This was all happiness.
Yeah.
But yeah, and of course, I learned more, you know, like this about this charter. It was probably the townsmen of Bruges probably made up all these rights that they had, like on the spot, like when William arrived. Like, oh yeah, we've had this for like, yeah, you're not allowed to let these taxes in this month, or, you know, for, you know, we can't do that. We've never had that. No, no, that's an ancient right. So
yeah, you have to uphold these ancient laws that we've always had. And one of the things, another detail that I thought was really interesting is that when he shows up, they send a delegation of boys outside the city, and the boys have like bows and arrows, and they're like, if you're going to be our count, then you have to let us do stuff like hunt squirrels in the summertime, because we like doing that. And William thinks like this is pretty cool, and he like rough houses with the boys a little. And so the citizens are like, okay, well, he's come back with the boys. They all seem in a good mood. This is probably okay. But they have a really interesting things in here, and it's full of scandalous detail. Like, we were talking about Bertulf. He eventually does get captured. He's one of the people, I think, that sneaks out of the siege. He leaves his relatives behind. He sneaks out, he gets caught, and he's executed. But one of the people who isn't really instrumental in his execution is this William of Ypres, who it looks like was part of the plot at the beginning, or at least joined in right after the assassination. And so Bertulf's being led to the gibbet, and William yells out like, who was it that was involved in this plot with you? And Bertulf yells out something like, well, you would know. William of Ypres is like, throw stones at this guy. Yeah, he's a clown. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, what? You liar, you.
He's like, did not see it going that way. But yeah, that kind of detail, you rarely get that, because a lot of the people who are writing chronicles, you know, are just writing kind of the factual details. And there are many people who are writing stuff, even Froissart or Jean Lebel, they're saying that they want to do this in kind of an objective way. And Gilbert doesn't really care about that. He's not objective at all, and he doesn't try to be objective. And that's what kind of makes it a really colorful story.
Yeah, like there are, like, Gilbert is firmly like Charles's follower, and he sees this is like the divine punishment of God basically coming down on these traitors. These are all traitors to him.
Yeah. And he kind of works his logic around so that it makes sense. There is one point at which one of the traitors, he's obviously a traitor, but he goes through an ordeal, the ordeal of the hot iron, and he passes. But then later on, he continues to, you know, agitate and be a bad guy, and eventually he dies. And Gilbert is trying to reconcile this with the fact that he went through an ordeal and God said he was innocent, but yet maybe he's not. And that kind of stuff is what you had to wrestle with when during the time of ordeals, you know, or divine influence, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, like Gilbert is probably learning, he's probably growing up really fast, I think, as he's writing this. Like, I always had the sense he was a really young guy. He's a notary. That's his job. So he's a notary working for Charles. And then, like, he's kind of seeing all this. He's a new, you know, ruler's coming in. And I think it's because it's so unpolished, his work. He's like throwing it out there. Like, I think if he sat back like 10 years later and wrote this, you know, we'd have a much different kind of view, right? Like, his kind of thinking would be all kind of settled, right? But you don't get that. You're getting his kind of raw, you know, emotional kind of stuff. So, which is great.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because many of the chroniclers that are writing, they write from further off, like a longer distance in time. And when you read their stuff, it's very formulaic, and they use a lot of, they just borrow phrases from the Bible or from the church fathers when they're filling out their prose. Gilbert does that, but not very much. And he kind of leans back on the same ones over and over again. And I think you're right, if he'd come back to this and wrote it later, kind of with a distance, that he probably would have had a more conventional account that we would see instead of this one.
It's interesting. This work is one that is not very, it wasn't like well known in the Middle Ages. Like, I think there's only like one copy that was ever like kind of found. So like, we don't know very much about Gilbert at all after this, or what became of him. This one manuscript survives. His kind of opinions weren't used by other kind of sources and stuff like that. So You know, it's very different. So
yeah, and that's another really good point in that you always have to bear in mind who is the audience who's reading this. It's not always clear who the audience is going to be. Usually you have a really official audience, like they might be writing it for the abbot, for the house, or for a prince, king, whatever. And that really changes how you write an account of things. Like, obviously, Gebert doesn't, he's not writing this for a prince if he's saying, you know, all you princes, yeah, really, you really suck. And so so the way he's writing that, it's not deferential in the way that you'd have another chronicler who's writing it, for example, at a royal court. He seems to be writing it for posterity, but not officially. So it's kind of interesting how this manuscript actually survives, considering it doesn't seem to have been commissioned by anybody. Yeah, just somebody who's there and said, this is really important, I should write this down.
Yeah, like we do have a couple of like other versions. Like we have like the kind of a account of like Louis the Fat, the deeds of Louis the Fat by his prime minister, Chouguère, right? And that's like Louis comes in and he settles everything. There was just a whole bunch of problems. There's this murder. Louis arrives, he made sure he put justice, and he left. That's which is how Sugar kind of writes about everything what Louis does. So
wow, Sugar quotes it.
Yes. You know, so you have that the official, like, and there's a few other like accounts as well, but nothing like this kind of level of detail or epicness, I guess.
Yeah, in this one, Gilbert's talking about one of the conspirators named Robert the Young. And it's hard. The translator's not sure how young he is necessarily, but he's clearly a crowd favorite. Everyone in Bruges loves him. And they keep petitioning Louis to let Robert out of the tower without the tower of the church where he's hiding, let him out without any consequences, or at least not any dire consequences. And there's a part where they ask him, I think, like on April 15th to let Robert out. And then they ask him again on like April 18th to let him out. And Louis's like, there's something in here about how Louis's so irritated with them for asking him again about this Robert guy. But he just doesn't listen to them because he's like, enough already.
Yeah, once Louis arrives on the scene, like he kind of takes to charge. Like William Toledo is not in charge, right? Like Louis is like, all right, we're going to do a siege. We're going to get these people. We're going to exact justice my way, and he does. He eventually forces. Basically, they start undermining the tower, and it, like they once they know they just kind of, you know, the gig is up. They have to surrender.
Yeah,
and that leads to another epic moment.
Yeah. So I don't know. You tell me what the epic moment is for you, and I'll tell you what it is for me.
Oh, it's the punishment of these guys.
Yeah.
I think that's where it really convinced me, wow, this is incredible. Like, I think if you kind of view the Middle Ages as like really violent, you know, this is not going to dissuade you because they take everyone up one at a time up this tower and toss them off.
Yeah. Yeah, they toss them off the highest point, the tower of the house. They call it a house in this translation, of the castle where this murder happens. So yeah, they toss them off one at a time.
Galbert's like, oh, the first one he lands and he's dead. Like he cracks his skull. Second one lands and he's still alive for a few seconds. Like, oh, and then he dies. And there's like a part, you know, like then like, you know, there's like a point where like one is like still surviving. So some women come out to kind of like try and take care of him. And there's very few women in this account, by the way. So like this is man on man violence. So, you know, like they come in and then like the soldiers throw stones at them, at the women to get them to, you know, run off so he can just, this guy can bleed out. Oh, it's just, you know, it's just such an impactful kind of scene. And I think that was the whole point, was like everyone's going to see what happens to these guys.
Yeah. So. And it's a super detailed account of it because so they finally move to the topmost tower of the church and they're hiding. And Louis sets people to work at the bottom of the church and they realize, you know, they're going to die. So they have to come down. And, you know, Gabriel is explaining that they are. There's 27 people. They come out and they're looking just gaunt and starved and tired. And they come out and they're put into a cell together. The cell is so small with so many people that like they can't even lie down. And someone comes to the cell and says, you know, the king has decided he's going to deal with you leniently. And so they're like, yeah, they come out one at a time. get brought to the top of the tower. And yeah, the first guy falls just as he's leaning over to look down. He falls down. They let one guy pray before he dies. But you're right, there's not a lot of women in here, and they're always trying to help people and cure them. So they're helping people and curing them. And the guys who they're trying to cure still get dragged out of houses and stuff. They're not allowed to help.
Yeah,
they're not. They don't appear very much at all.
Galbraith's like he's a notary, he's a cleric. I don't think he's got like any kind of essence of like who the people in the larger town are. You know, you think he's a bit closed off in that sense, right? Like whenever he kind of talks about the town, we don't get like, oh, Joe the villager was saying this. You know, it's like the townspeople are all one, right? You know?
Yeah, they're all one. They're all one, but they're totally different than the people from Gand who are coming to help. So they're totally different. They're better. The people from Bruges are better. But there's small details about town life as well, where there's one point where somebody shows up to start the fight again, and everyone's just sitting down to eat, and they think that's kind of uncivilized. And then another person later on, like a year later, he comes and he tries to draw people out of the city to fight, and it's like, we haven't even eaten yet. Like, seriously. these small details are what really stand out to me in this book. So it didn't have a huge impact, like you say, in the Middle Ages itself, but it seems to have been fairly popular since then, in that people from that part of the world are reading it more often. But is this the only translation in English, or is there another one?
Yeah, the one we've been looking at is the James Bruce Ross, which was translated, I think, in the 1950s. And that's the one, like, if I think 99% of people that have been read it would have read that. But Jeff Ryder did a translation in 2013. And the title of that is the more like official of what the actual Latin version is. And he calls it The Murder, Betrayal, and Slaughter of the Glorious Charles, Count of Flanders. Something. So
that's
so adult. British writers said, like, you know, there are some like translation problems with the original one, with Ross's version. So it probably needed an account. But I think like The Murder of Charles Good has been published in by University of Toronto Press and Medieval Academy so many times that there's lots and lots of copies kind of just out there. So it's fairly easy to get like as a used copy. But if it's something, if you're really interested, you can kind of check into Jeff Ryder's version of it as well.
Yeah, the older one that we both read by James Bruce Ross, it's very friendly text in that it's a translation. It's from the 50s, so it's, you know, the translation is not maybe as energetic as you tend to have now, but it's very easy read. Because it's in translation, you don't have to worry about it being in Middle English, Middle French, or anything like that. You can just read it as is. And there are plenty of footnotes, although, you can see the footnotes are getting a little bit dated. But you can definitely follow the story without having to really lean on the footnotes too much.
Yeah, like I would think like you don't even have to really go into the introduction. You can go straight right into a text and just start reading it. And it comes off. And I think it's probably because of Galbraith's kind of style where he says everything.
Yeah. I mean, normally I might not say this, but for this particular book, I would say don't read the introduction first, at least in this translation. Just jump right into the text and then go back, because the introduction almost assumes that you've already read it. And so it's very, very dense in what it's talking about. And it's kind of off-putting. So if you're reading this particular, the James Bruce Ross translation, just jump right into the text and let it carry you, because it's quite the story. It's a lot more lively than many other medieval chronicles that you have about this kind of thing. So any other reason why people should read The Murder of Charles the Good, Peter?
Well, Medieval Warfare magazine, we did an issue on it about 3 years ago. So it was actually one of the first topics I really wanted to get done. And it was like, I got Jeff Ryder, I got a couple other scholars to kind of deal with like urban warfare. So we have like an issue kind of with that on that theme. I think if you're a military historian, there's a lot of kind of interesting like just aspects of like that kind of gritty urban fighting that you don't kind of see too much. But I think overall, it's just such a fascinating kind of story on its own. I think is one way, yeah, is like if you want to kind of look at that kind of aspect, that kind of warfare and violence aspect of the Middle Ages, I can't think of any better text to start with. And it's just kind of very fascinating kind of look, you know, a very one-sided look, to be honest, of like what this conflict is. But, you know, and I love it. It's like it's something, yeah, I would recommend to anyone that's kind of interested in the Middle Ages to read. So yeah. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. I really did enjoy it. I was, yeah. And then, you know, there's fewer people in it than in the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, so I can follow it better. But yeah, it's really energetic. And I think it's good for people who are kind of getting into the Middle Ages and want to see these people as people. And yeah, I would say for people who are interested in military history, the details, as you say, of urban fighting are really something. Don't give it to people who already have a really bad impression of the Middle Ages, because this is like, this is civil war. It's not like everyday life. But yeah, I'd say I'd recommend it to people who are kind of at the beginning of their journey, or if they just kind of need an account that is more energetic than you have often when you're looking at Chronicles.
I think this is one where I would expect that like a Hollywood, like Netflix series would be done about this, like these events, just because A, they're so kind of focused. We have also a lot of kind of great characters within it and action scenes too. Like this is very much, this could like rival Game of Thrones, right? Like, yeah, I could definitely see, you know, someone like, let's do a version of this based on like with these events and kind of like just do 10 episodes and you kind of tell this whole story.
Yeah, that would be something. We should pitch that to people. Netflix could do the murder of Charles the Good, but it should be that Jeffrey Ryder's translation. Definitely that title, I think, would be a good one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Peter, for making me read this over my vacation. It was a great vacation read. All right. So what's going on with the website these days? I've been away, so tell me what's going on.
So we have a great piece from Elizabeth Smith Rosser about book care in medieval China. And I've really been liking her columns so far. So like, it's just like, just kind of fascinating just how aspects of, you know, books and libraries, how they were done there. We haven't done this in a while, but we posted a castle for sale.
Nice.
So if you have like 300,000 euros, there's a really nice ruin in northern France that you can buy up. And we also did a review of Norsemen, which is a Netflix TV series, just released season 3. It's a comedy, a Viking comedy. I'd say, I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but yeah, I would recommend it. It's pretty funny at times. It was really popular in Norway. They did a Norwegian version, English version at the same time. Same actors, pretty much same lines too. So the Norwegian one was a huge hit, and then they put on Netflix and it became, I don't think they expected it to be a big hit, but it's certainly well worth watching, Norsemen.
Okay.
So we talked about that.
I have to check that out. I haven't seen it yet. It's been recommended to me by many people and I haven't done that, but hey, you know, if we're still going to be in quarantine for a while, that is my next show to watch. Anything else on the website we should know about, or we are good to go?
We are good to go. There's we've got some more stuff coming along, and you're gonna have a lot of posts,
yeah,
I imagine, coming out. So
yes,
it's all gonna be all Danielle. That's for the next little while.
Yeah, this is what I get for trying to take some time off. Well, thanks, Peter. Good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you, as always, to all of our patrons on patreon.com for all your generosity. It's your patronage that makes this podcast possible, so every little bit is appreciated. Patrons can always get sweet deals on Medieval Warfare Magazine, The Medieval Magazine, our book club, and an ad-free version of Medievalist.net, but now we've got something new just for you. Every month you can also get a fresh new map of one corner of the medieval world, illustrated by Tina Ross. These maps are being made exclusively for our patrons, so you won't find them anywhere else. Which just goes to show that all the coolest kids are patrons of the Medieval Podcast. You can find out more at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from assassinated counts to Norsemen, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can always follow me, Danielle Sabalski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. You can also find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.